Well, good morning. How are we? It's good. It's good. It's probably worth saying that noise that you're hearing, are you hearing that noise? It is the blood-curdling scream of a child. That's what it sounds like to me. I'm there. If you're hearing a noise, some of you might not be able to hear that noise, but if you are hearing a noise, we think it's the wind. So don't worry about it. Someone came up to me and said, this sounds like a kid screaming. It's like our EV Kids program. If kids muck up, we tack them outside. It's terrible. It's all okay. Everything's okay. What we're going to do this week is we're going to wrap up Ecclesiastes. We're going to put it to bed. And the way we're going to, sorry, just so you know what's coming too, over the next few weeks, we're going to look at a couple of Psalms, and then we'll be diving into our next series in the third quarter of the year, which will be the letter of Galatians. So that's what's coming for us. But today, the intent is to wrap up the book of Ecclesiastes, and I'm going to attempt to do that by summarizing some of the main things we've heard, as well as getting to these final words where we're commanded to fear God and obey his commands. And as we actually dive into this final section, so come back to Ecclesiastes if you're still in 1 Corinthians. Come back to Ecclesiastes, and we're looking at verses 9 through to 14 there. And as we look at those verses, we're actually invited to think back over everything we have been hearing over the last 10 weeks. We're invited to cast our memory back and acknowledge what has been coming our way. And really what we've been hearing is this. We've been hearing the voice of a wise teacher who has been testing life under the sun and presenting his observations and conclusions. And we are called to, he's been wanting to present those to us so that we would heed his wisdom. So our task is to make sure we've listened and to make sure we've taken note of the wisdom that's been brought our way and to make sure that we've heard them like goads and firmly embedded nails. That's our task. Could you pick that up there in verse 11? The words of the wise are like goads. Their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails. Now, what does that mean? Now, some of you have already figured out what that is. A goad is, apparently, I'm not a farming type. You can probably tell. There's no calluses in there. A goad is a stick with a sharp bit on the end that you used to jab an animal, yeah, or prod an animal to either get it moving or to get it moving in the right direction. It's heading off in the wrong direction. You give it a prod. Sounds fun to me. You just get to prod the animals, right? It'd be good to have one for the kids. Is that right? She says that in reflection after many years. So the concept is these words of wisdom that have been coming at us are meant to be like goads in that they've meant to be the kind of thing that have jabbed us or prodded us into action. It caused us to move or at least change direction. So we need to consider that. These words of wisdom are meant to be nudging us out of our comfort zone towards and heading in the direction we're meant to be going. So wisdom that's coming at us is meant to actually have got us moving in some way. Has that been the case for you with what you've been hearing over these 10 weeks? Has it had any change for you? Has it brought any action for you? Has it caused any kind of course correction for you? Because that's what it's meant to have done. If you've heeded the words of this teacher and you've heard this wisdom from God, it ought to have changed something. Has it? Secondly, it's meant to be not only a goad but a firmly embedded nail. That's an easier one to kind of get. A nail that's firmly embedded is something that sinks deep and stays in. These words of wisdom are meant to be the kind of things that sink deeply into our heads and into our hearts and stay with us, remain long term. They're the kind of things we're meant to make sure we don't forget them. We're meant to hang on to them. So they're the two things that these lessons of wisdom are meant to have done. They're meant to be like goads and firmly embedded nails. They're meant to have sunk deep and got us moving. So what are the lessons that have been coming our way? What are the pieces of wisdom that have been coming at us? If you've been with us through this whole series, I trust that you will have noticed something here on the weekends, in your groups during the week, and in your personal reading. I trust you'll have noticed this, that there are certain messages that the teacher just keeps coming back to, yeah? There are certain teachings that we keep hearing over and over again throughout the book. week in, week out. It's and the messages are, you know, things like death, work, pleasure, wisdom. Death, work, pleasure, wisdom. Work, death, pleasure, wisdom. Death, pleasure, wisdom. You got me? Have you been noticing that? It's almost cyclic the way it works in the book. And that's a bit different for us because we usually are perhaps more, a little bit more familiar with the New Testament letters, which are kind of progressive in their argument. They move along in one direction and then they arrive at a conclusion. Whereas the wisdom literature that we're looking at, it just keeps going up and around. It drifts in and out of one topic area, around the back, and all of a sudden it's in the same one again. That's wisdom literature for us. And some of you have found that kind of frustrating or a little bit annoying because, you know, you arrive at the week or you've been leading your group and the passage you're looking at this week, it's like, oh, it's about death. And you think, didn't we do that last week? Yep. Didn't we do it 2 weeks before that? Yep. We're there again. Now, why is that? Why is it that the same thing keeps coming up time and time again through the book? It is no mistake. This is the author's intent and design to keep going over some very similar messages again and again. We are hearing exactly what was intended for us to hear over and over again. It would appear, brothers and sisters, it would appear that there are certain things that we apparently need to hear over and over again. And I assume that that's because there are certain things that we tend to easily forget over and over again, even on a weekly basis. And when I say forget, I don't just mean forget intellectually. No, no, you remember you heard that. But you forget to actually allow that to impact the way you live on a weekly basis. And so we need to be reminded of them over and over again. And the reason why we forget, I'll put that right up front, the reason why we do forget big things is two reasons. There's a problem within us and a problem around us. If you're a Christian, your heart has been regenerated. Yeah, it's been given life so that you actually have desires to honor God and love God. But you live with sin remaining. So the struggle with sin will remain. And so your heart will continue to chase things that are apart from God. You will, by nature, still go after the wrong things. And you'll need to be brought back on course time and time again. You can almost anticipate that there will be a tendency in you every day, even though you are redeemed by the Lord, there'll be a tendency in you to wander. And it'll come from within you. It's not just around you. It comes from within you, a corrupted heart. But add to that, the world that we live in has been corrupted as well. And so we're continually influenced to stray and head off in the wrong direction and move away from our Creator. And so I say we need to be continually brought back, which is why we together come under the authority of the Scriptures week in, week out, and right throughout the week, because we trust that we need to hear these things. Even though we may have heard them before, we need to hear them again because we forgot them. And sometimes it can only be a day or even a couple of hours before we forget them. So can I invite you to, in humility, trust that even though what we're going to look at just now is what we have already looked at over the last few weeks, that you need to hear it again, that I need to hear it again, and we need to reflect on it again. Can I invite you to come? And I say in humility, because it does take humility to hear these things again and trust that we need to, because we've strayed and we've wandered. Soften your heart and come with me. The three big things. I started out with eight, and looking at the big things that come to us through Ecclesiastes, I saw eight to begin with, and I thought, no, that would just take all day. We can't do eight. So I tried to combine some of them together, and I've boiled it down to three key lessons that come to us from the book of Ecclesiastes, or at least three of the key lessons. You can be the judge. Some of them have already actually come out in the reflection time, so we've already heard them, and we're going to hear them again in the same service. Isn't that fantastic? Repetition. Apparently, we need to hear it. Here are the three things, and just so you know what's coming. Number one, the pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. But we need to hear that one every week, every day. The pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. Number two, much of your work is actually in vain. And number three, this is the best one, soon you will grow old and die and you will not be remembered. We're just going to have a party this morning, okay? Just so you know, I'm not a sadist. I'm not the guy who wants to go and dwell on things that depress me. I find this quite challenging to hear these things over and over again. I don't want to dwell on them, to tell you the honest truth, in my physical, natural man. But I trust that if this is what the Lord has for us in his word over and over again, then there is going to be great benefit for me and for us to keep dwelling on these things. So we go back there. Here's the first one. The pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. I feel like it's almost as though the teacher, the wise teacher here, is taking a hold of us by the shoulders. He's looking us directly in the eyes and he's saying, would you just believe me on this one? Would you trust me on this? I've pursued pleasure with more time and energy and money than any of you will have at your disposal. I've gone after it more than you will ever be able to in things in life under the sun. And you need to hear my conclusions. You need to hear what's at the end when you arrive at all those things. And effectively what the teacher does is he pursues, I think, the three big life stage pursuits that we go through in life. And in each different area of life, the early stage of life, the middle stage of life, the end stage of life, there are different types of pursuits that we have to go after pleasure. Come back to chapter 2 and you'll see his pursuit of pleasure. And I want to suggest that they're in those three different categories. There's the early stage where he pursues parties and fun and craziness and drinking. There's the middle stage where he pursues being productive and going after projects. And then there's the end stage where he just pursues the epic lifestyle where he kicks back and enjoys his retirement years. And these, I think, are the three main areas we pursue to find happiness and pleasure and satisfaction in life under the sun, and he goes after them and lets us know how it goes. So the first one, perhaps the early stage of life, you might suggest, where young people want to party and be crazy and drink a lot and have fun, he tries that. Verse 3, chapter 2, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. Now, when this may very well be King Solomon or a king like Solomon. When a king like Solomon tries cheering himself with wine and embracing parties, he does it in the form of throwing huge parties night after night after night. And you can see the details of the kind of parties that King Solomon threw when you trace it back in Kings. He threw parties that where he would be able to play host to up to 20,000 people. And he would do it night after night after night. He would feed them. They would feast. They would drink great wine. They would have incredible entertainment. You name it, they did it. And they ramped it up every night, night after night. And he does it for months. I mean, it just kind of makes our backyard barbecues where we tell people to bring their own meat seem really lame. Because he kills hundreds of beasts to get enough meat to cook to feed 20,000. And he does it night after night after night. You can track down the details. But he obviously gets to a point where it just grows a bit old, gets a bit bored, gets a bit repetitious. And some of you have been there. You're like, yeah, I partied when I was young. Yeah, it's fun for a bit, but then it gets boring. And so he moves on. He moves on to the middle stage of his life where he decides, I'm going to do something productive with my life. Yeah, I'm going to build some things. I'm going to buy some things. You know, and I see our tendency. We all want to do this with the middle stage of our lives. We go after epic projects and say, verse 4, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards for myself. Now, when he says he builds houses for himself, plural, it doesn't mean just two houses or three houses. Now, he builds a house for every one of his wives. And he had 700 wives, if it's King Solomon, and 300 concubines. So this guy goes and builds possibly up to 1,000 houses. He builds suburbs of houses. And the kind of houses that you and I we can't even dream of them. He builds them. He does that reno you've dreamt of, but he does it a million times bigger. He supersizes everything we've ever done. What he does effectively with his building projects and his purchase of land makes our, you know, house and garden shows that we watch and salivate over on television just seem really, really lame. And when he says he plants gardens the size of forests and vineyards that just stretch for acres and acres and fruit trees that just go forever. He built it, constructed it. If you've dreamt of it, he did it. He owned it. He's already done that. He's been there. So we can ask him how he felt when he'd done all that, when he'd built everything. And he really wants us to hear it. He finds it a little bit fun along the way and kind of exhausting, but then he decides, now that I've done all that, I need to sit back and enjoy it. I need to sit back and enjoy the lifestyle that I've built with my hands. And so I would suggest he enters into that third stage of his life where he wants to live the epic lifestyle with all that he's constructed for himself. And so verses 7 through to 9, you get him just pursuing that. And I won't go through the details of it, but basically he builds for himself an entire service industry that is at his beck and call. He's got chefs, and he's got baristas, and he's got cleaners, and he's got masseuses, if that's a word. He's got personal trainers. He's got everything. He's got entertainment that's constantly rolling. He's got live bands that are playing for him. He's got productions that are just private audience for him. And he's got 1,000 women. He says they're the delights of every man's heart. 1,000 women. He has basically unlimited and uninhibited sexual experience. That's what he goes after. All the kind of things that people go after to pursue pleasure and happiness and satisfaction in life, he does it all. And at the end, he gives us his conclusion. He says, here's what it's like. Verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in my labor, and this was the reward for my toil. So he does say, look, I got some delight along the way. My heart took delight in my labor. In other words, there was some joy along the journey, but that was it. That's the reward. Because when you get to the end, here's what happens. Verse 11, yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained after the sun. He says, when I got to the end point of everything I thought would make me happy, when I arrived at that place, I realized it just doesn't do it for you. I didn't feel like I thought I would feel. I didn't have what I thought I would have. And he's basically trying to hold us by the shoulders and say, just trust me on this one. Those things that you're going after, when you get them, if you get them, and when you get them, here's what you'll say to yourself. Here's what you'll find the situation you're in. You'll get those things, that car or that house or that relationship or that experience. When you finally get it, the thing you're holding out for, you get it, you'll find yourself saying this, oh, well, that didn't do it. And you'll have a choice whether you then invent something else to go after, or whether you pursue the truth. You can either go after the lie or the truth. The lie goes like this, and here's the lie we're continually told right throughout our lives. What you need to make you happy is simply more of what you've already got. That's what we get told over and over and over again. What you need is just more of what you've already got, a bigger version of it, a more modern version of it. We get told, so the minute we arrive at something, we hear immediately we need the next version. We see it with technology. The minute you get a phone, all the OS system gets updated and your apps don't work, so you've got to get the next phone. You've got a car and it works fine, but you're continually getting told, no, you need that next model up because you better fuel economy, more power, safer for the kids. And you're like, okay. And you can walk up to it from behind, you can go like this with your leg and the boot will open. I promise you, if you get that car that you can walk up to and go like that and the boot opens, number one, here's one of two things will happen. Number one, the boot won't open. I don't know, it just won't work. Or number two, it will open and you'll be standing there with your hands full going, oh, well, that wasn't that good. I promise you. You see it with our food, actually. Here's a little example. You see it with the food. Here in the West, we have every single different type of food we can get our hands on. But we continually invent new versions of them or combine existing things because we think they're going to be better. Yeah, you've heard of the turducken, right? At Christmas time, we're not happy with just turkey. We want turkey and chicken and duck all together. So you put the duck in the chicken in the turkey and you cook it all together. It's called the turducken, yeah? These days, that's not even enough. You've got to wrap it in bacon as well, right? Like, what are we doing? We're just thinking, oh, if we can get it all, then I'll have that Christmas that I've really wanted. You see, with all the little things, I went down to a cafe the other day and I bought a duffin, which is a donut and a muffin. Yeah? You haven't lived until you've had a duffin, you know? And then someone else told me about a cronut, which is a croissant and a donut together. You know, you've got to step back from what we're doing and just acknowledge, like, we're just chasing something and we're just continually combining what we've already got to see if we can find it there. It's this pursuit of pleasure in all the little things and in all the big things. We're hunting happiness. And we will always hunt happiness, by the way, because we're actually designed to hunt happiness. The problem is not that we pursue pleasure. The problem is where we pursue it and how we pursue it. If we continue to pursue pleasure in life under the sun, we will continue to be completely unsatisfied with where we find ourselves. The truth is, real, lasting satisfaction and pleasure can only be found in the one who is beyond the sun, the Creator. Now, Jesus says it to the woman at the well when he's having that little interaction with her. They're talking about water, and he says to her, ask me and I'll give you living water and you'll never thirst again. And she doesn't get it. She's like, well, you don't even have a bucket. You know, she's not understanding. He's gone deep and spiritual. He's trying to help her see, you know, what you're hunting for with all the men in your life, because she's gone from man to man to man. And he's saying, what you're hunting for there, that thirst you've got, will be satisfied in me, in relationship with me, your Creator, your Saviour. Real satisfaction is found in me, not in things. This is a message we need to hear over and over and over again, because we forget it on a weekly basis. Real satisfaction is found in our Creator, not in His stuff. It's in Him, not in His things. Friends, has this piece of wisdom been like a goad and a nail for you? Has it sunk in deep? And has it caused there to be any change and action and movement in your life? And I can't help but to think, if it's going to cause action and movement, the first thing it's going to cause is just causing us to stop pursuing pleasure in the same old things all the time, thinking that we'll finally arrive when we get that thing. And to start more seriously just pursuing Him, our God, and relationship in Him. So there's our first one. The pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. Here's a second one. Much of your work is actually in vain. And I've got to say, this has got to be one of the hardest ones for us to swallow and wrestle with. Much of your work is actually in vain. And friends, I preached a sermon about a month ago here on Sunday morning and on Saturday night. And it's interesting. The result of this sermon has been interesting for me. It's almost polarized us. There have been some people who have sat with me and said, that's one of the best sermons I've ever heard. And other people have said, that is one of the worst sermons I've ever heard. And I know you're out there because you've come and you've spoken to me, bless you, some of you, and you've written me emails, and someone even wrote me a letter. That's fantastic, a real letter, posted it to me. That's awesome. And I just want to say, that is exactly what we need to do with each other. Someone said to me, oh, you're probably only still getting the tip of the iceberg, which scares me. There's a lot of you out there, you know, concerned about what we looked at that week. Please feel completely free to share your concerns and your frustrations with whoever preached the word. Because the truth is, we sit together under this, yeah? You don't sit under the authority of the person out the front. Now, we sit together under the word of God. And so where there are questions or clarification needed, please feel free to approach and talk. And I've got to say, I've really enjoyed the opportunity to be able to do that with a number of you since a month ago. So let's dive back into it again and kind of stir things up again. No, not stir things up. I do want to attempt to clarify, because it is the kind of area that needs a bit of clarification. I won't be able to do too much of it, but just a touch. Much of your work is actually in vain. The teacher is reflecting on the work and the toil and the labor that he's given himself to in his life. And he comes to a very clear conclusion. He says, it's meaningless. It's vanity. It's in vain. Now hear this. When the teacher says meaningless, and he's speaking about his work and his toil, he's not saying zero meaning. He's saying, when I look at the result of all of my work and toil and labor, in the end, it amounts to nothing permanent. That's what he means by meaningless. Nothing permanent. The gain that comes from my work, he's saying, is just temporary. It's just momentary but it doesn't last very long, and it certainly doesn't last much long after I'm dead and gone. That's what he means by meaningless. It's not permanent. You can see it in chapter 1, where he starts there in verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labours under the sun, all their labours at which they toil under the sun? You get to chapter 2, verse 17, follow me there. So I hated life. He's really quite distressed as he reflects on the result of his work and how momentary the result is. I hated life because the work that is done under the sun is grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to one who comes after me. That's what's really eating him up. He's like, everything I work for, I can't take it with me. It won't ring on. It's not permanent. I've got to leave it here behind and someone else who didn't even work for it gets it. What is with that? It's frustrating him. And he's saying, really, is that it? Is that easy? Is that all that's left from all of my labor? Just temporary, momentary. He says, if that's the case, if it doesn't ring on permanently, then I say it's meaningless. That's him saying it's in vain. Now, that's distressing and it can cause despair when you think back on the life you've lived or you're thinking about what you're currently doing until you get to the New Testament and you discover that there actually is a kind of labor. There is a kind of work that is not in vain. And that's what we did about a month ago. We went to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 58, and we see Paul's instruction at the end of a chapter where he's been reflecting on the resurrection of Jesus and the result for us. He gives us instruction. It's a very clear instruction, and we've got to really make sure we unpack the phrase properly. He gives the instruction to Christians, and he says, always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord. Because the labor of the Lord is not in vain. So there is a kind of work, there is a kind of labor that's not in vain that we are called to always give ourselves fully to. And what that means, that's great for us because it means that there is a kind of work that is permanent. There is a kind of work that lasts on into the future after you're long and gone. And really, what we need to do is unpack what the meaning of that phrase is, the work of the Lord, the labor of the Lord. And those of you who have struggled with my conclusions here or disagree with me, I would love to hear your thinking on what you think Paul means when he says the work of the Lord, the labor of the Lord, because that's what it's all about here. Paul seems to be making a distinction between two kinds of work in his own life. And this thing that he calls work of the Lord, I think when you trace through his teaching, you see clearly he's speaking about, more specifically, disciple making when he says the work of the Lord. Disciple making and please hear this one, because I think some of you didn't hear it last time. The work of the Lord is disciple making and any efforts that contribute towards that cause. Particularly any efforts that contribute towards the strengthening of the church whose primary mission is the cause of making disciples. Any efforts, little, big, anything that's done, formal ministry, informal ministry, anything's done that to build up the church and strengthen the church so that more disciples can be made is the work of the Lord. And it's not in vain. And it's not in vain because God's word never returns to him empty. It always accomplishes exactly what he intends it to do, whether that be salvation or judgment for a person. What is accomplished will last beyond this life. It will ring on for all eternity. Paul makes a distinction between the work of the Lord that he does and other kind of work that he does, which he actually calls chapter 9, 1 Corinthians, work for a living. Paul makes a distinction. And I think once you can see the distinction that he makes, then we can start talking about an area where a lot of you want to talk about, which is the overlap between those two areas. But if you just jump straight to the overlap and start talking about how all of life is the work of the Lord, then you'll miss out on a very important distinction. And there's a lot at stake in this. But once you get the distinction between those two different kinds of work, then we can see there's overlap. And I'll illustrate the overlap. It's this. Paul calls his tent making work for a living, chapter 9. But I can only imagine that in his tent making, Paul did a fair bit of work of the Lord. Because I can only imagine that as Paul was there making tents alongside other kind of buffy blokes who made tents with him, that he would have been saying to them, have you considered this Jesus fella? And I can only imagine that in that connection, which I can only imagine Paul did, there would have been people who came to Christ and heard about Jesus or were at least nudged along to consider things about Jesus. And I would say when that's happening, there's the overlap, you know. There's the mixing of those two types of work together. And there are lots of different examples about that. Sometimes our work in the home as parents raising kids can very much be the work of the Lord if our efforts to parent and raise kids are actually done with the mind of, I am making disciples here. So it can be. It can be. It's not always the case, but it can be. I want to kind of leave it there for you. And please, if you've got more thoughts and questions, obviously there's so much more clarification that can be brought to that. But here's what's at stake. Your days are valuable. They're few, they're numbered, and they're valuable. If there is a kind of work that actually is not in vain, if there is a kind of work that you can give yourself to that is permanent and eternal and rings on forever, then maximize your energies and your efforts toward what is more clearly and specifically that work and minimize other work. And I know many of you have done that over the years and are continuing to do that now because you've got eternity in mind and you want to make your days count. That's what's at stake here. That's how we let this piece of wisdom be a goad and a nail that sinks in deep. We don't take ourselves so seriously that we can't analyze what we have done and what we are currently doing. That we can step back and say, well, what do I actually do with my day, my week, my year? Honestly, how much of it is work that's going to reap results that are just temporary, which are not evil, but just acknowledge they're temporary? And how much of my life am I giving toward the kind of work that is actually going to result in and contribute towards things that are permanent and eternal? And if we're going to heed this wisdom, we're going to do everything we can to lean toward maximizing our energies and efforts and work in that area particularly. Yeah, and that's different for all of us. It's different to what it means to maximize, what it means to give ourselves fully to the work of the Lord. It's for each of us to consider. Yeah. Third one? Ready for the third one? Oh, I've been going long. Here's the third one. But this should be easy and quick. Soon you will grow old and die and you will not be remembered. Come back to chapter 12. Andrew touched on this last week. Oh, he did more than touch on it. Soon you will grow old and die and you will not be remembered. These are hard things for us to consider. What's coming for us all what he says here in verse 1 of chapter 12 are the days of trouble. That's what's coming for us. And we're told to remember our Creator in the days of our youth before the days of trouble come. And I just want to encourage you all. Some of you think, the days of my youth are long gone. No. I think the days of trouble are what happens after the days of youth. And so the days of trouble are described in such a way that if you're able to actually get out of bed this morning and get yourself here to church and you're still sitting upright and you're able to listen in any way, you're still in the days of your youth, people. You've still got some life in your bones and in your body. Yeah, you're still in the days of youth somewhat, all right? You are, because the days are coming, the days of trouble are coming, and when they're described by all the metaphors you get from verses 2 down to 5, the metaphors for aging, they're really horrific and they're really hard to face. And when these things come for us, you won't be getting out of bed in the mornings. You won't be coming here because when you look at how deteriorating each of these things are, and really what we've got described there is lots of different members of the body breaking down. And it's horrific to kind of listen to. It considers all things. It tells us what's going to happen in our minds and our brain capacity. It tells us what's going to happen with our plumbing. It tells us what's going to happen with our... It does. Andrew got a roar of laughter last week when he spoke about prostate and bladder problems for a few moments there. It tells us what's going to happen with our arms and our hands and our legs and our back and our necks. It tells us what's going to happen to our hair and our eyes and our teeth and our sleep patterns and our sexual desire. And then it tells us we're going to die. And it tells us that it's going to be frustrating and painful and undignified. And I feel the beginnings of all these things already. I've got another week. I've got 1 week before I turn 40, so I'm still in my 30s. But I'm feeling it, people. I know you're like, no, you're not. But I like I've had operations on my eyes. I've got bony growth in my ears. I've had root canal in my teeth. I've got a sore back and neck. It's just the beginnings of all these things are coming for me. I ain't seen nothing yet. I know that. I know that. I'm a baby. I know. But look, I know I ain't seen nothing yet because I can reflect on Scripture and the teacher wants me to know what's coming. He wants you to know what's coming. He wants you to feel and face the devastation of aging. And he wants us to feel it in such a way that we would reflect on the ugliness of sin, because it is sin that causes us to age and die. We wouldn't age and die if sin didn't exist. It's our rejection of our Creator that's mean humanity goes this way. So we're meant to reflect back on the horror of sin and our offence towards God. But ultimately what we're meant to do here is we're meant to reflect on this, be devastated by this, and find ourselves turning and seeing the days that we still have and making the very most of the life that we still have. Now everyone in our community loves that concept, yeah? Make the most of the days that you have. And people will be very creative in the ways they come up with how to make the most of the days you have, seize the day. But we're told exactly how we are to seize the day. We're told exactly what we're meant to be doing with the days of our youth. It's very clear, verse 1, we are to remember our Creator. We're to live with Him in the forefront of our mind and our hearts. We're to chase Him with all our strength while we have it. We're to remember our Creator. And while we're doing that, the final sting on all this is really the word that we're going to grow old and then we're going to die. And then, after you're gone, you need to know that no one's going to remember you or even hear you. And you get all that back in chapter 1 where the teacher says, look, generations come and go. And no one remembers the generation before it. There are people who are yet to be born, but when they are born, they're not going to remember us. And for some of you, that's a blow. Others of you are like, oh, I don't really care. You know, I'm looking forward to when I go. I don't care if no one remembers me. But others of you are concerned about your own significance. I'd say probably most of us are. And we like to think that we live with a level of significance that means we're going to leave our mark somehow. We're going to be remembered somehow. And you will be. You will be. Your kids, and perhaps their kids, and some of your friends will remember you after you die. But then they'll die. You know? And then they can't remember you if they're dead. So it's going to happen for us all eventually. None of us will be remembered very long. I'll give you a little illustration on this one. How many of you remember Willoughby Bean? Does anyone here even know who Willoughby Bean is? That's funny, because he was, you would say, the most famous, well-known, well-respected person on the Central Coast about 150 years ago. Back in the early 1800s. He was the fellow who actually owned all of the property between Terrigal Lagoon and Wamberal Lagoon and West, a big triangle that kind of comes out all the way here to Erina. And he owned most of the property that you and I live on now. And he was very well respected and did a huge amount to establish the community of the Central Coast. You don't even know who he is. I don't either. I had to go hunting through the history books to try and find out who he was. What about Henry Donaldson? You know who he is? Oh, he was the fellow who came in after Willoughby and bought up his property and lived in his estate and developed the timber industry on the Central Coast. And he and his family actually did huge amounts for the community here to make it a viable place where you could come and live and work. These are men and women and families who have gone before us and lived in such ways that are far more significant than you and I will ever live. And 150 years later, a couple of generations have come and gone and we haven't got a clue who they are. So we do need to face the facts. A day will come, probably sooner than you'd hoped, where you will be completely forgotten. A day will come when no one will even have a clue that Tim Baldwin existed. And I need to face that fact now and let it impact the way I live now. And I'll tell you what it does for me. It gets me thinking, okay, if that's the case, then really my legacy is not going to be my name. It might be I pass on my name through a couple of my boys to their family. But really, my legacy is not going to be my name, but my legacy can be his name. Yeah? It may be that no one remembers me, but it is possible for me by his Spirit to live in such a way that helps the next generation to remember Jesus. And that sounds better by far anyway, doesn't it? I say we do that. I say we live in such a way that we leave behind an entire generation of people who know Jesus and love his word. And I say we do everything we can to leave behind resource that would equip the ministry after we're well and dead and gone. Things like this and many other things. I think we do everything we can to live in such a way that allows Jesus to be remembered. What would it mean for us to live in that kind of way? What does that kind of life look like? Well, I reckon the teacher tells us here in chapter 12. The conclusion of the matter is this: fear God, obey his commands. We live in that way, our legacy will be the name of Jesus. Come and have a look. We'll finish up on this one. The conclusion of the matter is this: fear God and obey his commands. Verse 13, this is the whole duty of mankind, meaning this is the whole of mankind. This is the whole point and purpose of your existence, to fear God and obey his commands. Notice this one with me. Proverbs begins by saying the fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. Ecclesiastes tells us the fear of the Lord is effectively the end of all wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning and the end of all wisdom. It's the beginning and end of all of life. It is a very central concept. This is it for us. We are to fear our God. Now, some of you hear that and you say, amen. It sits well with you. It makes perfect sense to you. You love the concept of fearing your Creator. Others of you, if you be completely honest, are a little bit uncomfortable about this concept of fear. And might I suggest why it is you may be a little uncomfortable with the concept of fear? It's easy to live with an understanding of fear that is, I want to suggest, one-dimensional. It's just simply that fear is a bad thing. It's a negative emotion. It means being frightened and scared and terrified and of someone or something that causes you to want to run away from it, run in the opposite direction. If you live with a one-dimensional concept of fear, then this won't make sense when you're told to fear your God. Because you're like, why would I fear him? Why would he want me to run away from him? But you get to the Bible and you see that really the Bible uses the concept of fear in what I want to suggest is a three-dimensional understanding of the concept. It's far more complex. And the fear that we get told to have in the Bible is a fear that I want to say is a healthy fear. It's a right-placed fear. It's the kind of fear that instead of causing us to want to run away from God, it's a fear that actually causes us to actually draw near to him in reverence and even rejoicing. That's the kind of fear we're talking about here. It's the kind of fear that instead of binding you up, it actually releases you to live the very life that you were created to live. That's the fear we're talking about here. And when the Bible talks about fear, in particular, you get this in the Psalms, and I'll have to wrap up soon. I'll do that in a minute. The fear, this concept of fear that you see in the Psalms continually puts fear alongside other things that we think is the opposite of fear. So Psalm 2 says this: serve the Lord, which sounds nice, with fear. And then it says, celebrate his rule, rejoice in him with trembling. It's like, hang on, what does fear and trembling got to do with serving and loving and rejoicing and celebrating? But the Bible just puts them together, which tells us that this fear that we're called to have, the fear of God we're called to have, is the kind of fear that's going to cause us to actually burst out and love our God and draw near to him and rejoice and serve. Psalm 22 says, those who fear the Lord praise the Lord. Psalm 147, which Jez read right at the beginning, some of you might have missed it. Psalm 147 says, those who fear the Lord are the ones who put their hope in his unfailing love. Are you someone who wants to increase in your hope in God's unfailing love and know it better? Are you someone who wants to praise the Lord? Are you someone who wants to serve the Lord? Are you someone who wants to actually rejoice in him and have joy in him, but that's not happening for you, or it's less than what you think it should be? Fear may very well be the problem, or fear may be the answer. Fear is the thing you need to press into, which will result in these things. It's like fear is the root of our relationship with God, and joy is the fruit that comes from it. And I want to suggest the deeper the fear, The deeper the root, the higher the fruit. Healthy fear, fear that leads to joy and rejoicing. Can we press into that kind of a life? Because ultimately that's going to be a fear that leads to joyful obedience, which is why we're told to fear God and obey his commands. Yeah? Fear that leads to joyful obedience. It's a fear that's based on an understanding that he's the one who made me. This is his world and I live in it. And very soon I'm going to be standing before him and need to give an account for the way I've lived in his world. Which is why Ecclesiastes finishes with verse 14 about the fact that judgment is real and we will all stand before our Creator. It says, "For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil." And if that's true, if it's true that I'm going to stand before my God, then that does cause me to want to fear him now in a healthy way. It does cause me to want to live carefully before my holy God. It does cause me to want to seek what pleases him and be most concerned what he thinks of me. Friends, healthy fear leads to joyful obedience. Fear is the very heart and key and root of our relationship with God. It's in right-placed fear of our God that we will be led to live lives that actually cause people to remember Jesus long after we're dead and gone. I'll leave it there. Let me pray.